So our visitor this week is Ingrid Robbins. She's a professor of philosophy at Erasmus University in Rotterdam. She's one of the rare people who've pursued the strategy of getting a PhD in economics in order to become a philosophy professor. Her PhD is from Cambridge, 2001, 2000-ish?
Two.
Two? 2002, yeah. And this week she's talking about gender and family justice, and today's talk, oddly, you can see what it's called, What Do Just Family Policies Require? Philosophical Reflections in the Case of the Netherlands. And she'll talk for something up to an hour, and then we'll have about half an hour or a bit more for discussion. Ingrid.
Well, thank you, first of all, for inviting me, and thank you all for coming. I'll just start with the presentation so that we have as much as time as possible for discussion. What is the topic of the paper? We know that governments can do a lot to make lives of families easier or more difficult. And there are a number of ways in which the government can do this. For example, I've listed the most important one here. The government can use the fiscal system by having certain tax breaks or certain benefits in the fiscal system. The government can provide child benefits. A second way is that the government can provide leaves. Most importantly, there are maternity leaves and parental leaves, and also paternity leaves. But there are also other possible leaves like sick leave or something they have, for example, in Belgium called a time credit. A third way in which a government can make lives of families easier or more difficult by not having these provisions is by regulating the labor market. For example, the government could require that part-time workers be paid the same hourly wage as full-time workers. It could have protections, effective protections against discrimination or firing of pregnant women. It could also have minimum wages and all these kind of regulations of the labor market. A fourth way is that the government could provide all sorts of other institutions and public goods that are particularly relevant for families, such as how it designs the healthcare system, whether or not it finances public schools, whether it provides childcare, funds it, regulates it. So as soon as you start thinking about what the government can do and does or does not, you see that it's actually, there are many different ways in which the government can affect families. Now, social scientists have provided a massive amount of evidence that the first years in life are especially important to for that life to go well. And family policies have been argued to be a social investment that will benefit the society at large. Yet family policies are also important for lifetime equal opportunities, since the unequal experiences of children early on in life are likely to generate inequalities in outcomes over the rest of their life. So there are many different reasons why we should take family policy seriously, both because of this social investment argument, but also because of arguments of equal opportunities. A few years ago, I started a research project which tries to look into these issues, especially from the point of view of social justice. So the questions that I am trying to answer in this project, of which I'm giving you sort of a work in progress version today, is what would a just policy be if you want to be just towards the family? What would just policies be is, of course, a question that is derivative on the question, what are the just principles of justice? So the more fundamental question is, what are the principles of justice in the area of the family or that apply to the family? And once we know that, we can then answer the questions, which are just family policies? And I'll try to answer both these questions just in 1 hour, which means that this paper is going to be sketchy. It's going to touch on many different issues. It will provide a sort of an overview of literature and of the research project that I'm pursuing. I think for analytical philosophers, this is going to be a bit frustrating because we tend to develop the arguments in depth. And of course, I can't do this if I try to cover this whole area. But I'll first of all try to make up for that tomorrow by then focusing on one topic, and also I think in the discussion time we can elaborate on some particular issues which you think are insufficiently argued for. Now, before I will go to propose a set of principles of justice that are relevant to the family, I want to say something about the sort of philosophical paradigm in which I work. And I call this the earthly justice paradigm. And I'll try to be very brief about this, but I think it is important because there are philosophers who work on the family who work from a very different perspective. Very briefly, the earthly justice paradigm is concerned with real problems, hence does not pursue knowledge for the sake of knowledge. So it's really, it has this pragmatic edge, and it also has this practical edge. Practical both in the common sense understanding of practical, but practical also as we use it in practical philosophy, namely how to guide our actions. A second aspect of the earthly justice paradigm is that empirical claims or empirical information that is used in the theorizing needs to be plausible and as valid as we can get it. So and one important aspect there is to try to avoid assumptions that assume away important aspects. For example, I think in theories of justice, one of the aspects that has been really insufficiently highlighted is the fundamental dependency of human beings on other human beings. So Eva Kitte has written a lot about this, that she calls it the elephant in the room. So that the fact that human beings are dependent for many years of their life, actually for all their lives, but in some stages they are fully dependent, and then we are less dependent, and perhaps when we are older we become again more dependent, that this is something we should take on board structurally and not just as this additional thing. It should be really integrated in our entire thinking. And the third aspect of the earthly justice paradigm is to be aware of the distinction between ideal and non-ideal theorizing of justice. Ideal theory tries to give us a picture of how the fully just society would look like. So ideal theory gives us principles of justice and defends them, and when these principles would be met, we would reach a fully just situation. Non-ideal theory, however, tries to answer the question, how do we get there? And how do we prioritize these different dimensions of justice? What kind of strategies do we need to pursue? And there's a lot of debate nowadays about whether ideal and non-ideal are useful and necessary and so on. My position in this is that both are necessary, both are useful, and I will actually in this paper do both of them. What I will first do is I will give you 12 principles of justice. 5 are at a general level. They're just principles of justice that do not particularly apply to the family, but that I will then use to work out principles of justice for the family. And they are, that's more or less ideal theorizing of justice. And then at the end, I will, based on these principles of justice, I will give you a set of policy proposals which I think would get us far in giving us a just family policy. I will make special references to the Netherlands. There is a pragmatic reason and a more intrinsic reason. The pragmatic is that I live in the Netherlands, and that so I know quite a bit of the institutional details. However, I think the Netherlands is also an interesting case because many of these policies have been relatively recently implemented. So as you will see when we discuss the policy proposals, some of them are, I think the mixture is quite unique. And I hope to convince you that there is something that we may learn from looking at this country. In the comparative social policy literature, actually, there's always a lot of referencing to the Scandinavian countries, but I will also make a few comments on these countries because While writing this paper, I've discovered some critical notes about some of the Scandinavian countries. Let me put it a bit like this. Okay, so what are these general principles of justice? The first one concerns the scope of justice, and the principle that I endorse, which actually many philosophers working on justice endorse, is that the scope of justice is limited to the domain where human beings can exert an influence and make a difference. Hence, justice should always be about what human beings can do for one another, and this does not mean that nature is not relevant for justice, but nature is only relevant to the extent to which natural forces lead to inequalities in people's quality of life or to their freedoms, and whereby these inequalities can be rectified or compensated for. Let me give you an example. A natural fact is that only women can give birth. Men cannot give birth. Being pregnant and giving birth is a risky thing to do. According to the United Nations, in the developed countries, for every 100,000 babies born alive, about 9 mothers die either during labor or directly after labor from the consequences of giving birth. However, if you compare these figures with other continents, in Southern Asia, it's not 9 mothers, but it's 490 mothers. In Sub-Saharan Africa, it's 900 mothers for every 100,000 babies born alive. So while it's most likely impossible to avoid all maternal deaths, human interventions can make a huge difference, such as, for example, by making sure that there are skilled healthcare workers assisting delivery. However, if despite the best healthcare available, a mother unavoidably dies in childbirth, then from an analytical point of view, this is not an injustice, even though it is, of course, hugely tragic. But to call it an injustice must imply that we could have made a difference. And there are just some things in life where we are not in control and cannot make a difference. Now, I think these determinants of human advantage can be put into two categories, broadly those that are man-made and those that are not man-made. For example, the man-made categories are gender is one of the man-made categories. Gender, which I understand as the social meanings that we attach to masculinities and femininities, or to male and female bodies, is something that people have invented. It's not given by nature. What is given by nature is sexual difference. It's the biological differences between men and women. However, gender has an effect on the distribution of human advantage. And since gender is invented by humans, and it can be changed by humans, it falls within the scope of justice. So these kind of factors I call pure social determinants of human advantage. They're just social. But on the other hand, you have the ones that are caused by nature. Some of these factors are outside the scope of human influence, such as the example that I just gave of the unavoidable maternal death. Let's call them the pure natural determinants. They are outside the scope of justice. However, they're also the ones that are mixed. So these are, of course, the tricky ones, and they are within the scope of justice. So if the aspect, for example, in the example that I gave, if maternal deaths can be drastically reduced by having health, by having skilled healthcare workers present at birth, then that is a social determinant, the presence of healthcare workers, that makes it a matter of justice. So the natural and the social are often linked. And I think especially in the case of gender, as soon as you start to look at particular issues, the natural factors, namely the sex and the social factor, gender, they often are linked. And then the discussion becomes really difficult, as we will see in detail tomorrow in the paper on the gender division of labor. So that's just to say something about the scope of justice, which is the first principle. The second principle concerns the metric of justice. And the principle goes like this. In judging whether an arrangement or an outcome is unjust or not, we need to take people's quality of life into account, which should be conceptualized in terms of functionings and capabilities. I hope most of you are familiar with capability approach, which has proposed this idea of functionings and capabilities. I'll just say very briefly something about it. Functionings are people's doings and beings. So it's aspects of people's lives. Examples are being healthy, being cared for, being part of supportive social relationships, being educated, being well-fed, and so forth. In many circumstances, namely there, in those circumstances where we can reasonably assume that people are roughly autonomous, the focus should not so much be on the outcomes that people have, but on the opportunities that they had. And these opportunities we call capabilities. That's just in three sentences the essence of the capability approach. In the terminology of contemporary theories of justice, this metric of justice basically is about the question, what are you looking at if you decide on whether something is an injustice or not? The claim that I'm endorsing is that we should look at people's functionings and capabilities. So not so much at their income or whatever. These factors are important, but only insofar as they are derivative for these functionings and capabilities. And in the case of family policies, care is a crucial aspect, and being able to give care and being able to receive care are both capabilities. The third principle concerns the agency of justice. And the principle goes like this. The agents of justice do not only include the government, but can also comprise individuals, groups, and organizations. And the reason why I've added this principle is because I believe that in contemporary theories of justice, there is a statist bias. Theories of justice overwhelmingly suggest in their work that the government is either the only or the primary agent of justice. And of course, I do agree that there is a very large and a very important role to play for the government in enhancing justice. This is why I present this paper, because in the end I will have this long list of policy proposals which I argue that the government should implement. However, I believe that there are also other important agents of justice, and that when we think about the family, this is especially important. For example, when we think about the gender division of labor in the family, hence the way husband and wife divide up the paid and the unpaid labor, there's only so much that the government can do. At some point, it's really the question, how do the individuals in this couple, how do they decide to divide up this work? And much will also depend on their individual actions. For example, if they are put in a position to choose a just gender division of labor, do they do this, or do they rather use their bargaining position or the power that they have to get the best outcome for themselves? So there is, at some points, there is scope for individuals to choose for a just path or for one that where their self-interest prevails. So that's why I believe that we should, when we talk about justice, we should not automatically assume that we're talking about the government. The next principle is some version of luck egalitarianism. There's lots of debate about what luck egalitarianism precisely is, so I just say some version, and goes like this. People should not be disadvantaged due to the social and the mixed social natural determinants of human advantage, which are beyond their control. This is especially important when we think about children, because, of course, for children, most of the situations in which they find themselves, they have had no control over it at all. Children are born into families, they don't choose their parents, they don't choose the class in which they are born, they don't choose their natural talents and abilities. And luck egalitarianism is, in some sense, a very radical principle, because it says that people should not be disadvantaged because they happen to have had bad luck in the natural lottery. And finally, the last principle, which I think will be somewhat more controversial, is that everybody who is able to contribute should contribute to meeting the needs of those who are entitled to their needs being met on grounds of justice. Again, this is something that I don't read much about in the literature on justice, but justice is not about only getting what one morally is entitled to. Justice is also about contributing what is needed to make society more just. And if we take as an sort of a factual assumption that there will always be many people in society who are in need, who cannot care for themselves, such as severely disabled, frail elderly, infants and children, and to some extent also those who provide the unpaid care for those dependents, then we immediately see that there are claims of justice that these people may have on us and that have to be filled in by somebody. So society needs collective resources, i.e. money. Society needs money to materially support those people. I believe it is the duty of justice to provide for those who are entitled to support, and that therefore it follows that we all have a duty to contribute to meeting the needs of those vulnerable people. However, I should clarify this a little bit. The principle implies that adults who are able to contribute should contribute, either through paying taxes, which can be used to meet the needs of vulnerable people, at least if you have a government that then uses the taxes to meet the needs of people. But you can also directly meet the needs of those people, for example, by caring for a disabled family member or by doing volunteer work for a vulnerable group. Taking initiatives that will lead to a situation of contribution are also discharging people from their moral duty to contribute. For example, there is in the welfare state literature lots of talk about activating, but people willing to work also have to be able to find a job, and that is something that, especially at the theoretical level, is often not taken into account. The principle, this principle of fair contribution, implies that able-bodied adults who have no caring duties and who do not contribute either by working or by paying taxes or by doing other socially valuable work are not discharging their duties of justice. And this is relevant in the area of family policy. And let me give you an example of the Netherlands. The Netherlands has a conservative family ideology. So for a long time, the ideal was that mothers would stay at home. And also the welfare state provisions enabled mothers to stay at home. But the welfare state provisions have changed, and people have changed, the norms have changed. And I think that in the current situation, given the enabling conditions that are created in the welfare state, lifelong homemakers who are not doing socially valuable work are not discharging their duties of justice. And in the Netherlands, there is still a generation of women who, once they become parents, leave the labor market and never return to the labor markets. And my assessment is that, given the extensive welfare state provisions that we have in the Netherlands, everybody should contribute if they can and if they are put in a position in which they can. And just to give you an idea, what I mean with these general welfare state provisions, we have, for example, in the Netherlands, a universal basic pension. To be entitled to the pension, you have to live in the Netherlands for between the ages of 15 and 65, so that's 50 years. For every year that you live in the Netherlands in this period, you're entitled to 2% of the basic pension. It doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter whether you work or whether... It doesn't matter. You just have to be there. You don't have to be Dutch. You just have to be a legal resident. And in 2009, so this year, the net amount of the basic pension was 813 euros a month. And for married people, 566 euros. The effect is that we have very few poor elderly, which I think is a fantastic result of the welfare state. But I do think that it also means that if you have this kind of welfare state provisions that There's also some things that citizens should do. Now, I am aware that I actually surprised myself with this fifth principle, because this kind of contribution talk often comes from political corners where I do not situate myself. And I also have a history of being sympathetic to the basic income proposal, which of course is in some tension with this fair contribution principle. But I guess that by opening the principle to socially valuable work, which is a very broad definition, it can be rescued from these corners. So these are the general principles of justice, which are the kind of background frame for my analysis of what principles of justice should guide family policies. In what follows, I will first discuss principles that relate to children, then principles that relate to parenthood and procreation, and finally, I will give you some principles that relate to gender issues. So, first, children. I already mentioned that there is lots of sociological research showing that people have drastically different starting positions in life. Under most accounts of justice, the effect of family backgrounds on people's lifetimes opportunities for flourishing are considered to be a matter of justice, because it's beyond the control of individuals in which family they are born, and these effects of in which family you are born can be either amplified or softened by policies and also by individual and social actions. When we are thinking about what justice for children requires, I therefore think that the first principle that I have here on the screen is something that most people would agree on. It's a lifetime equality of opportunity principle. Children should have the same lifetime opportunities insofar as these opportunities are not restricted by natural differences. So, for example, if you have a child that is born blind, and there's no way to make it able to see again, then this child will not have the opportunity to become a pilot. That, of course, is I would say this is not an injustice. However, if a child from a poor family would like to become a pilot and that will never have this opportunity, it's not realistic because it will never go to college, then the child doesn't have the same opportunity than other children do. So that's the kind of intuition behind this lifetime equality of opportunity principle. But of course, in the first years of life, the very notion of opportunity is rather misplaced when we think about children. Children do not have the relevant agency when they are babies or when they're infants or small children, and only very gradually children develop the agency that you need to have to be able to talk about opportunities. So this implies that in the first years of life, we should provide children with the same levels of adequate care, and we should focus on meeting their needs rather than on thinking about opportunities. And that then brings me to the second principle about principle of justice for children, which is, as long as children are not sufficiently capable of exercising agency, their needs should be met at a sufficiency threshold. I've put their agency in the relevant domain because it can, of course, be that in some domain children will develop agency and the ability to choose and to take on some responsibility earlier in life than in other domains. This is a strong child-centered principle of justice, which frames justice entirely in terms of children's need, independent of any responsibility questions that could be assigned to the parents for creating the child in the first place. The principle of meeting children's needs raises the important question what meeting their needs entails. We know that children are human beings who are vulnerable in several ways. They are small, they cannot care for themselves, they are born without possessing social and practical skills that are useful for survival, and they are vulnerable to abuse because they are immature, and they are, and if they are abused, whether physically, sexually, or emotionally, then this may have an impact for a long time in their lives. Children are human beings at an early stage of development, and therefore they need proper care and nurturing. So, in short, their vulnerability and their particular stage of human development makes it easy to see why they are entitled to care, support, nurturing, and protection from adults. And this is reflected in the United Nations Convention of the Rights of the Child, which has been ratified by all countries in the world except Somalia and the United States. Now, luckily, Jane Waldfogel recently, a few years ago, wrote a book in which she carefully analyzed what children need. The book is called What Children Need, and I think she did a fantastic job in describing the available state of the art of empirical research for different age groups that summarizes what children need. Her book is extremely careful and balanced, and I can really not do justice here by summarizing it, so I will just say a few things which will be relevant for the policy proposal that I'll end up with. But anybody interested in the area of the family is warmly recommended to just read the book. The first important conclusion that Waldfogel draws relates to the care of very young children. She finds that maternal employment early in the first year of life, particularly if it is full-time, is associated with poorer outcomes for children. These outcomes are health outcomes, but also attachments to parents and behavioral outcomes. Interestingly, on the effects of paternal employment, we just know nothing. There are just no studies being done on the effects of paternal employment, and it would probably also be not so easy, because to do good quantitative research you need to have a lot of variation, and if most fathers work full time, then you may not have enough data to do this kind of research. So you would need to set up very targeted studies, which apparently have not been done. The studies that she reviews also stress the quality of parental care is crucial. This is actually something that in the public debate, certainly in Europe, is actually virtually missing. So it's not so much only about whether children go to daycare or not, but an important issue is what is the kind of care that children get from their parents. If babies receive sensitive parenting at home, if parents react in a sensitive way to their needs, and if they are in high-quality daycare on a part-time basis, then the negative effects of maternal employment in the first year of life go away. A second finding that she has is that generous parental leave policies are associated with better health outcomes for children, in particular because parental leave facilitates breastfeeding. That's the health outcomes. Maternal employment in the second and third year of life is unlikely to have these negative effects that they have in the first year of life, though again, if you have poor quality non-parental care, and if you have poor parental care because it's insensitive, then this may lead to bad outcomes for children. However, and here you see how nuanced she tries to be, she also finds and says that if maternal employment raises family incomes, especially for families where this makes a difference, then there are positive effects on cognitive development. So money matters and time matters. This is an open door, but the specific combination of the two and the age of the children needs to be taken on board. For older children, some of the important findings have to do with the beneficial effects of preschools, which should be available to all, and also after-school programs for older children, which both can have positive developmental effects, but also they can avoid that children have to care for themselves, which increases the likelihood of negative behavior. For example, children hang around and experiment with drugs or sex or stealing or criminal behavior or whatever. So she argues there that after-school programs are also important. So these are the two principles that relate to justice for children. Now, if you think about these two principles, if we would meet them, this would lead to very extensive family policies. And these policies would not just benefit the children, but clearly they would also benefit the parents. It's very difficult to have policies that where you want to do something for children, which then will have no effects on the parents because they are like a package deal that come together. Therefore, the principle of meeting children's needs raises the question what justice for parents entails. And the question what justice for parents entails also brings up the question of justice between parents and non-parents. Because non-parents may say, well, and this is the kind of conversations you hear in popular discussions, if you have a child, it's your decision. I do not have a child, so I do not want to pick up the tab for your decisions. And this, I think, is, when we look at this from a philosophical point of view, the question what parental justice entails is one of the more difficult questions. And that's the one we will turn to now. Well, now we know that from Nancy Faubourg's very careful empirical work that raising a child is very costly. She did some fantastic work on the US where she calculated how much it costs to raise a child. And she finds that in a family where you have three or more children and where you hence have lots of economies of scale, a child, raising a child costs $128,000, whereas if you have a child that doesn't have siblings, so a single child, it's $205,000. And in most, well, actually in all affluent societies, the government bears some of these costs. For example, subsidizing education or some child benefits. However, there are other costs, such as foregone opportunity costs, which are not included in these estimates. And we also know that there is a gender dimension to this because most of the costs of raising children are borne by mothers rather than by fathers, especially the time costs and also the cost of foregone earnings and other lifetime opportunity costs. So we see that this becomes an issue where everything is linked, and it raises the question, who should bear the cost of parenting and for what reasons? In the philosophical literature on distributive justice, one prominent view is that parenting is a lifestyle choice, and that parents should not shift the cost of their choice on non-parents or on parents who have fewer children. The reasoning behind this is much inspired by recent developments in liberal theories of justice, which centrally rely on the distinction between choices and circumstances, and justice, so it is claimed, would require that people be held responsible for the consequences of their voluntary choices, whereas they should not be held responsible for the circumstances over which they do not have any control. So this links back to this principle of luck egalitarianism. If, for the purpose of deciding what we owe each other in a political community, we accept that having children is a choice that people make, and it should not be considered as something that simply happens to them and over which they had no control, then it follows that having children is a choice and that parents should pay for the cost of choice. I actually think there is a lot of... I've now summarized, of course, this philosophical discussion. I should say that I think there's a lot of philosophical elegance to this kind of reasoning, and that it also fits very well with mainstream political philosophy thinking about distributive justice. And for a long time, I found it quite hard to see what was wrong with it. But luckily, other people have showed me what was wrong with it, and I think they made some very compelling critiques on this view. Daniel Engster has recently written a paper where he gives three reasons why it is a mistake to see children as a private project. His first argument is that parenting is often much less voluntary than other projects. He argues, I quote, "Parenting is something that happens to individuals without their fully wanting it or planning it. Men and women may involuntarily become parents because of lack of foresight, faulty contraception, limited access to contraception or abortion, or various other factors not wholly within their control. That's his first argument. I should say that I do think that this, the strength of this argument also depends from country to country, because things like access to contraception and abortion is something that, and actually also sexual education is something that in the Netherlands I think would be a weak argument to make, but still. He has other arguments. His second argument is that parents who raise happy, healthy, and successful children generate numerous positive externalities for others throughout society. Well-raised children are more likely to be competent, reliable, productive citizens and workers than poorly raised children. Individuals who have and raise children further sustain society. If no one had and cared for children, society would cease to exist within a few generations. This is actually an argument that has been made by several other people. It's often called the public goods argument, which sees children as public goods. I think that Nancy Fulber was one of the first people who to put it this way. I have a few problems with this argument, but I think on the whole there is much to say for this argument. Engster has a third argument, which he sees as the most important one, and that is that parenting concerns the fostering of the development of another human being, and that children have a special moral status that other projects do not have. Since children have moral rights, which is also something that Harry has written on, they create moral obligations on all those who are able to meet them. Therefore, all individuals share some moral responsibility for enhancing the healthy development of children because they have moral rights. Other projects do not have such moral rights, and therefore the analogy between having children as a project and other privately chosen projects does not hold. So the type of arguments that Daniel Engster gives us, that's the first three here on the slide, are of two kinds. One is about the protection of the interests of third parties. That's the children as public goods argument. Namely, other people will benefit from the fact that parenting is supported. The other type of argument are the child-centered reasons. That's the third argument, that children have moral rights. So there are the child-centered arguments, there are the third-party arguments, but there is still a third type of argument, which is called the parent-centered reasons for support for parents. And that argument has been developed recently in a paper by Harold Brickhouse and Adam Swift. They argue that parents have an interest in the intimate relationship which they can have with their children, which is from a certain quality that is different from intimate relationships that adults can have with other adults. The parent-child relationship contributes to the flourishing of the parent, and it cannot be substituted by any other kind of relationship. The unique contributions that parenting can make to the flourishing of the parent thus makes parenting the appropriate subject of protection and support. I've given this very short summary because I think most of you probably know the article. I just think that it's a very compelling argument, and I also believe that their claims why parenting, the parent-child relationship is different, qualitatively different from other intimate relationships. I think that is that the arguments are strong. Thus, if we review these arguments that are recently been made in the philosophical literature, I do think that we have enough arguments to see why we need to support parenting. However, what may still be missing is an elaboration of which cost of parenthood would need to be socialized and which would have to be borne by parents. That is work that I myself have not done. I don't know of anybody who has done it in detail, but I'm happy to hear if anybody did. So for the time being, the only thing I can do is to give you a vague principle of justice for parents. And that's the next one. And that is, our societal arrangements should be such that they support parenting. It's vague because it doesn't say exactly what costs of parenting should be borne by society and which one the parents should still bear themselves. And that is, I think, something that is requires, first of all, a detailed taxonomy of the types of costs, and then an argument which one should be socialized and which one should not. However, it does not follow from this vague principle of justice for parents that parents should be supported in whatever procreative decisions they want to make. In fact, I think that justice, especially if we think about justice for future generations, both in our own countries, but also contemporary justice towards people who are living in areas that are vulnerable to ecological damage, especially related to climate change, forces us to think about whether there should be a limit on our procreative rights. Ecological demands of justice for future generations and for people living in ecologically vulnerable areas conflict with unlimited procreative freedom. And I think from the point of view of the ecosystem, the creation of a new life is always a burden on the ecosystem. And that, why is it a burden? There are two arguments why it is a burden, or two parts in which it is a burden. The first one is that every baby, even those who will be brought up and who will endorse lifestyle where they will have a very small ecological footprint, have a non-negative ecological footprint. You cannot be a human being and not have a non-negative, you will always have a positive ecological footprint. You cannot be on Earth and not require something from the ecosystem, all just because we breed and all the other things we do. Hence, every human being is a burden on the ecosystem, newborns included. In Europe and in the US, actually, as you all know, we have much bigger ecological footprints than people living in sub-Saharan Africa. This makes it even worse for us, but it doesn't change the fact that every human being is a net burden on the ecosystem. Secondly, a human being is living sustainably if her ecological footprint is not larger than the Earth's per capita biocapacity. So the Earth has, these ecosystems of the Earth do have the capacity to sustain a number of people. There is a biocapacity, and the issue is that the more people there are on Earth, the per capita biocapacity goes down. Because the biocapacity is at an aggregate level for the Earth. So that means that the more people live on Earth, the more difficult it is for an additional life not to be a net burden on the ecosystem. I think this is a very annoying thought for people who like families, but it has unavoidable consequences for parental justice. The vague principle of parental justice entails that parents should be supported in parenting and in their parenting activities. However, in ecological terms, every child is a burden on the ecosystem. The consequence is that the vague principle of parental justice has to be constrained in terms of the number of children that parents are entitled to have on grounds of justice. Of course, in the ideal world. I'm not saying that we should now have the one-child policy of China. I believe that for the sake of justice towards future generations, hence for the sake of the children of our children and their children, we must take into account this sustainability principle, which I have here, the demographic sustainability. The total world population should remain at a level where people do not endanger the ecosystems and the future of the planet. Of course, the total world population is just not a number. It depends on what lives these people will lead. I think that every person born in the US and Europe counts from an ecological point of view as, I don't know, 10 or 20 people born in Africa. So that is something we have to take into account. I am actually not sure. This is, of course, there are empirical questions here, because the family policies that I will soon be presenting, the question is, do these family policies, do they create positive fertility incentives that would get us to a world population that will be beyond the sustainable level? This is very difficult to say. I've read very little on this. What I know is that they say that these kind of family policies that support parents, that they have very little fertility effects. However, if they would have strong fertility effects, then the issue of trying to figure out what justice for families entails becomes much, much, much more difficult. Again, that's something that I think needs to be worked out. What I do think is that in any case, this principle of demographic sustainability must have consequences for the discussions that we have. I don't know the kind of discussions you're having here in the US about family policies, but in Europe there is a sort of a demographic panic because we don't have enough babies, allegedly, and many politicians want to... The motivations that many politicians have to provide family policies are not motivations of justice. They are motivations to do with sustaining the economic and social institutions that are underlying the economy, but also the welfare state institutions. For example, the pension system and all these and everything that basically costs money requires that we have a big enough workforce in the next generation, and that therefore we do not have low fertility rates. And this has led to a kind of public discussion whereby people who don't have children, especially people who choose not to have children, are negatively stereotyped. And I think this is rather troublesome. Some politicians have even proposed pronatalist proposals in the hope to increase fertility rates. For example, there was a German economist who proposed that parents should get additional pension credits and that non-parents should be fiscally penalized. I think this is quite troublesome because I do think non-parents do contribute something, all other things equal, namely they do not create an additional ecological footprint by having children. So Jan Pen, famous Dutch economist, has argued that rather than debating the option of penalizing non-parents, we should debate the option of expressing our gratitude to non-parents for their positive contribution to the survival and sustainability of the ecosystem. This is just about the type of discourse that we're having. I think the type of discourse that we're having in Europe is quite problematic because there is lots of talk about that women should have more children. And I think people should just do what they like as long as it is not leading to collective harm or issues of justice. And if it means that we have to pay more taxes to keep the pension system alive, then I think this is a better solution rather than to have all this pronatalist rhetoric. So these are the principles related to justice for parents. We are running out of time, so I'm going to be quick on the principles for gender justice. Family policies could, in an ideal world, be almost separate from gender justice questions. However, in the non-ideal world, they're very strongly linked. We know that mothers take parental leave, mothers bear most of the cost of raising children. So when we talk about policies, we also have to take into account how these policies will affect gender justice. And the Real Utopias conference that was held here in 2006 was precisely on this question: can you have a gender egalitarian agenda that tries to reconcile these questions of gender justice and the questions of work-life balance? I think that for a situation to be entirely gender just, three conditions should be met. The first is that the opportunity sets, in this case the capability sets for men and women, should be the same. They should have the same options. The only inequalities in the capability sets that are justified are those that are due to sex and that are not gender differences, hence these the nature side, and which in addition cannot be rectified by human intervention. So here you see these principles, the general principles that I had in the beginning, you see them reflected on the case of gender. So for example, the fact that only women can be pregnant, I think, is not an injustice. But if you decide to let women bear the full cost of the fact that they are the ones who get pregnant, then I think it raises an issue of justice. The second principle concerns the constraints on choice. If we have equal opportunity sets for men and women, then they should have the same opportunities to choose from these opportunity sets. However, we know that there are all these social norms and traditions and so on that influence the kind of choices we make, and gender is a strong factor that steers our choices and constraints our what we can choose from these opportunity sets. And the last principle is that this is, I think, it may be an economic term or a term from game theory, but the payoffs of the different options in this set need to be justified in themselves and should not be gender biased. With that I mean that if you allow men and women to choose, for example, for all professions or for caring, but all the professions that women are more likely to choose are worse paid, then there's also a violation of gender justice. So it's not enough to say you have all the options. You also have to make sure that those options that are more culturally laden with the female should not be worse paid without a reason. There can be reasons, but we have to have reasons. So these principles of gender justice come back tomorrow when I'll talk about the gender division of labor. So now, briefly, what are the family policies which I think are consistent with these principles? Almost all the ones that I will present to you here today have been proposed by Janet Gornick and Marcia Mayer, or by Jane Waldvogel. So I'm not doing much original work here. The only thing I'm actually concluding is that much of what they propose is consistent with this set of principles of justice. There are a few things where I think more should be done or where I disagree, but they're, I think, minor issues. I'll present them, I'll say how they link to the principles, and I'll also briefly say something about the Netherlands because it gives us an idea about political feasibility. The first is that there should be free healthcare for children, and there should be affordable universal healthcare for parents independent of their employment status. Why? Because free healthcare for children is needed to meet the needs of children, and because children should not be penalized because they have parents with certain jobs. So that's the first principle. And actually, we in the Netherlands, we had a healthcare reform 3 years ago, and they implemented this. So all children under 18 they have free healthcare. The second principle is that there should be fully paid and job-protected maternity leave 4 weeks before birth and 8 weeks after birth. I'm open for some discussion about the number of weeks, but not too much discussion. And the reason is this. In most European countries, we do have maternity leave that is fully paid or almost fully paid. It's also job-protected. However, in most countries, it's after the birth, it's much longer. It's 12 weeks. And it has a quasi-compulsory nature. You're given the leave, you're assumed to take the leave, nobody tells you what you have to do if you don't want to take the leave. However, we know from the medical literature that the time that you need to recover after birth is 6 to 8 weeks. So basically what happens here is two types of discrimination. On the one hand, women are getting paid leave that men don't get, and it's leave they get because of their gender, not because of their sex. They get it because of the fact that they're mothers, which comes together with all these motherhood norms. And so men are discriminated against. I've argued somewhere else that actually men should, they should be entitled to 4 weeks fully paid parental leave that they should be given by default. You can also see it from the other side, which is that women are also discriminated against because they are forced into this leave. Namely, if they don't want to have this leave, nobody tells them how to give it back. In the Netherlands, actually, for these 8 weeks, you are you are legally forced to take the leave. The details say of the legislation say that you can go back to work after the 8 weeks, but there is not on the website of the Social Security Administration, there's just not a single word how you should then do this. So I think this is actually a type of... here you see the working of gender. Because what we do know is if women stay more longer time at home, that of course this sets in motion the whole gender division of labor, which has consequences for many years. So that's the kind of maternity leave I think we should have to protect women and newborns. In addition, every parent should get 6 months of paid parental leave, again, which they should be given as a default. This default issue goes like this. If you currently, all the parental leave systems that we have, you have to apply for them. The problem is that often fathers do not apply for them because for various reasons, but some of the reasons have to do with the fact that they think they that the social norms in the organizations where they work are such that they will be penalized if they apply for them. If a child is born and both a child is due to be born and both parents get by default the leave, that is, there is some social security system that allocates the leave by default, then parents have to opt out. That means they have to do something to give the leave back. And there is literature in the behavioral sciences, in psychology and in behavioral economics, showing that defaults have a huge effect on what people do. In the organ donation literature, in donation about how much people save for their pensions, it shows that defaults have an effect on what people choose. So if you give people parental leave by default, this may be a way to increase the amount of time that fathers will take in terms of parental leave. Most European countries have parental leave. It often is paid. It's not always paid. In the Netherlands, actually, we do have 6 months job-protected individual parental leave. But at most, the first 13 weeks are paid, and whether or not they are paid depends on the sector in which you work. Just to give you an idea on take-up rates, in 2006, of all the entitled employees, 43% of women took it and 21% of men. However, what I think is very interesting is that most people take it on a very small part-time basis. So women took it for, on average, 10 hours a week and men 8 hours a week, and they spread it over a year. So often what happens is that after the maternity leave ends, both parents take 1 day a week parental leave. Often the mother then also takes a part-time job, and they combine this with 2 days of childcare. And it's interesting if you think about the research that Jane Waldfowell summarized, because she says that before the age of one, childcare, if it is high quality, if it goes with sensitive parenting, and if it's not full-time, it's not damaging. And that, I think, is a very interesting institutional fact. Because in Sweden, there is actually a very generally paid long parental leave, but there is no childcare provisioning for children under the age of one. So the option set is actually smaller. And the effect is, one of the effects is that you have a highly segregated labor market. Women all go into jobs, most of the time government jobs, which are lower paid and have a different career path. So the fourth aspect would then be high quality childcare, also for children younger than one, although I think it's good to have the option to have childcare just for a few days a week. Then work time regulation, the right to work part-time. Apparently the Netherlands is world champion in part-time jobs, and there is absolutely, as far as I can tell, no kind of culture that penalizes part-time workers. It's just, if you see job advertisement, it just says, for example, a job for 28 to 36 hours, and what you want is negotiable. So there is, I'm just saying this because it is a realistic utopia to have this kind of cultural change at the workplace. then I think there should be high quality public schooling that's free, and also after school programs. We had a very big problem with after school programs because we had all these mothers working at, well, staying at home, and because there is a shift from this breadwinner model to a 1.5 earner model in the Netherlands. 2 years ago, the government decided that schools would be schools were forced to organize after school programs if parents wanted them. Of course, in every school, there are parents who want them. Actually, schools do not have to organize it themselves, but schools have to make sure that it is organized. So we have this big sector of not-for-profit organizations that provide after-school care. They're regulated, and schools make arrangements with them. The problem is, of course, waiting lists, which is always a problem, I think, when you set up a new system that for which there is a high demand. Then there should be some emergency family leave for when there is an emergency with a sick child. Or there should also be longer-term unpaid care leave for severely ill family members. And I do think we sometimes forget in this discussion about family policy that they're not just children, they're also older people who need care, and that many people who work at some point in their working lives are confronted with severely ill parents, elderly parents, sometimes also terminally ill parents. And if you endorse a capability view on justice, you have to make room for this aspect of life, that people want to spend time with ill family members, especially when it's likely that they will be dying. Then the ninth policy is paid vacation, paid holidays, paid vacation days, which I'm just putting here because this is in the Walt Vogel book. We take this for granted in Europe that we have this, and actually, yeah, I cannot not imagine not having them. Finally, for poor families, there should be some financial support, because the poorer the family, the more difficult it will be for them to meet the needs of their children. And the final family policy that I propose has to do with this principle of contribution. I believe there should not be any positive incentives for stay-at-home parents of children older than a certain age, when meeting the needs of those children does not preclude the parents from working. This is a very conditionally formulated policy proposal, because it must mean that there are also jobs that these parents can have that do not conflict with them being meeting the needs of their children. In the Netherlands, we have actually a policy that violates this. We have something that the Green Party called the kitchen subsidy. In our fiscal system, we have a tax credit that amounts to 2,000 euros, roughly it's 2007. Everybody who either works or who is entitled to unemployment or disability benefits is entitled to this tax credit. And this tax credit is transferable to your spouse or partner. This means actually that people who are homemakers get a very modest homemaker wage. And that's why it's been called the kitchen subsidy. I think that people in all sorts of situations should be supported, but I cannot see how justice demands us to support people where we do not have the evidence that they are meeting the needs of people whose needs need to be met, or where they're doing something else socially valuable. That's what I had to say.